CliffCentral.com. Stay informed and up to date. It's the Daily Maverick Show, Tuesdays 1 to 2 p.m. on CliffCentral.com.
Good afternoon. You're now tuned into the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. As usual, I'll be your host for the next hour, Kingsley Kipuri. Today, we'll be talking all things Marikana, which has really been a front and center of the national dialogue over the past week. The Falun Commission that was appointed to look into what actually happened in Marikana released their report a few months ago. And after some time of the presidency sitting with that, we finally got it released to the public last week. So we're really just digging in what the report actually says, what it actually means, and looking into also the people affected who are not so sort of front and center of what we're hearing in the media today, and getting an understanding of what their perspective is on all this. I'm joined in studio by people a lot more knowledgeable than myself. Firstly is Daily Maverick reporter Greg Nicholson, who's reported extensively on this. He actually just got back from Marikana. Greg, always good to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Kingsley.
Perfect. Also is Grace Gomba, who is the family liaison of Socioeconomic Rights Institute, SERI, and she's been dealing very directly with the families of some of the mine workers that were killed. Grace, thank you for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Fantastic. Also, we have Dennis Webster, a researcher also from SERI, who's been a big part of disseminating the report and the findings of the report. Dennis, always good to have you here.
Thanks, Kingsley.
Fantastic. And last but not least, we have David Bruce, an independent expert on policing and criminal justice and use of force and all of that. So, Bruce, thank you for coming on.
Great. Hi.
Fantastic. Okay, so I really want to jump in, and I really want to start with, as I mentioned, the voices we've not been hearing so much. So a lot of focus has been on the executive, and also just on sort of people here in Joburg and in Gauteng on Twitter and so on, who are expressing our own outrage. But at the end of the day, let's be honest, we're very sort of far removed from some of these issues, and the people who are at the center of it, I think, are not getting as much sort of airtime and attention as they should. So Grace, I'd really just want to start with you. I mean, you've been working very closely with the families of some of the mine workers who were killed at Marikana. So can you tell us just a bit about what that's been like, so like during the commission and sort of post that, just what has it been like dealing with the families?
Well, first of all, I can't say it's been easy, even for myself. I mean, I'm not the one that's has lost the loved one through the entire ordeal, but I've worked with the families quite closely, and to me it made me feel like I'm part of the family as well. I've grown to know them, to understand their grief and to understand where they come from. So having dealt with the families on a personal level, it's been quite hectic, to tell you the truth. So it hasn't been easy. It still isn't to date.
What could you just give an idea of what your role actually was? Was it more of an emotional role? Was it more logistical, making sure they understood what was happening and transport? What were the aspects of your role as family liaison?
All of that included.
Okay.
Because as a liaison officer, I was initially called in to help SERI with regards to the families, to actually be the middle person between the families and their legal representatives. Okay. But, you know, as you know, things happen, you realize that there's more to it than being a liaison officer in that sense. So you have to make sure that the families are at the commission. You have to know who they are, how many families are coming, how many families are in a particular family, have to make sure that they have, like, all their needs are met, they're being attended to. I have to make sure that I do some translation, I convey the messages to the families, yeah. I attend their meetings, I make follow-ups on whatever requests they have. I'm just one person that they come to there with any questions or anything that they need. I'm the first person that they usually come to, and I have to make sure that I get it right, and I make sure that I get things done by them.
Absolutely. And in your role, as all these things which you're saying, some of it sounds, you know, sort of quite formal, some of it sounds very relational, mm-hmm. and more of an emotional sort of connection. What was your understanding of what were they expecting from the commission? So I think we all had a sort of our own little perspectives of what we thought this meant for us, but what did it actually mean for the families? What were they looking for from this, do you think?
They've had a whole lot of interviews, of which I was part of. I was doing some translation for them, and this question has been posed on each and every single member who's been interviewed. And they've been asked, what is it that you're expecting? And the main things that they were expecting were basically justice, closure, and accountability. So that's basically the three that I know of that I know they were expecting.
Okay, justice, disclosure, and accountability. And what did that mean to them? So I think, you know, I think we all sort of have sort of different understandings. And I know there's a lot of people, and it's hard to summarize in one line is what it meant. But what is your understanding of what that, those things meant to them? Justice, accountability, what does that mean to them, do you think?
They wanted a specific person being held accountable for the deaths of the loved ones. From my understanding, it would mean that by knowing that a certain person was responsible for the death of their loved ones, that would mean closure for them. It's not necessarily that they forget what happened, but at least they know. You know, you get the sense of peace knowing very well a certain person is held responsible for that. Because one of the questions that they kept asking was, has there been any police officer arrested or held accountable for any deaths? And, you know, we had to tell them that we're waiting for the commission to finish and the findings to find out if there's going to be anyone held accountable or liable for those deaths.
Now, Grace, I was just wondering if you can tell us a little bit about, as these families were searching for justice, closure and accountability, they had to sit through the Farlam Commission of Inquiry for, you know, almost 2 years, I think it was. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the challenges that those families faced, first sitting through the inquiry in Rustenburg and then in Centurion?
I can only speak, but anyways, it's just the same because they've been in the commission, be it in Rustenburg or Centurion, but sitting there on a regular basis, almost on a daily basis, having to listen to the evidence put forth about how their loved ones died, I know that was one of the most traumatic experiences for myself and even for the families. They would have to see the videos. They would have to listen to maybe say if SEPS is giving evidence against, you know, the families. I mean, it's not easy to take in what they were saying about your loved ones, saying the police attacked the loved ones. That I know it hasn't. It was not easy for them to take. So that was one of the things that I feel that was very difficult for them to take in.
I mean, thank you, Grace. It sounds like quite a challenging role for you, and I can only imagine the plight of everybody involved with this. I'd like to also just get an idea of since the report was released to the public last week, Grace, and I know Dennis, you've also been working on this, is what was the process of getting them to sort of understand the sort of the president's summary of the findings, the actual findings, and what it means for them? So what process was taken to make that happen? I don't know.
Okay, well, because we were in court the previous weeks, and the president was asked to release the report on the 30th, and we assumed that it was going to be released on the 30th, because we had to prepare our clients. So we were actually in the process of preparing our clients when the report came out, and when it did, we were not prepared because it wasn't the day when it was actually supposed to have come out according to us.
So when you say preparation, do you mean logistically making arrangements, or do you mean sort of almost like more of a mental and emotional process of preparing?
A whole lot of ways, because we were planning on actually bringing them to our offices and actually explain to them what the report means and what it is, and have some counselor with us, because we know that it wasn't going to be easy for them to hear whatever in the report. So now, as it came like that, it was abruptly, so we had to pack our bags and go, because we knew that the media was going to be there. There was no time for us to prepare them, you know, and we were not given time, anything like that. So it was just messy how it happened. So going there and actually having to phone them on our way there that, listen, the report is actually coming out by 7 o'clock, we hope to be there by that time, please assemble yourselves, we will be there as a group. And they were asking, are you really serious? This is coming out. We're like, yeah, it is coming. It is coming out. And we got there. It was even messier. The TV screen, we actually went to Lonmin's at LPD, one of the venues that we had organized. We went there and the TV was not working. We had to use one of the, I don't know who it was, but there was a phone that we had to listen on, and someone else had a laptop on the desk there, so we were sitting there and just
watching
listening
on the laptop.
So it wasn't easy on that day.
Jeez, and what I'm trying to think of just language barrier and trying to for a lot of people trying to understand the language being used by the president. Is that something that came up as a challenge?
Yeah. We normally do translation for the families, yeah. Because they're from the Eastern Cape. Mm. So we normally do the translation, and on that day, there's no way we can do translation as it's ongoing, it's happening, you know. And we're not even on a proper setup for us to actually engage the families on the report. So it was they could get a sense of what was happening, but it was not clear. You could look at their faces that they were not happy about the setup. They were not happy about what they were listening to. It was not just dignified how it happened. So to say, it wasn't dignified because it was supposed to have been a moment where we actually assembled them in a private place and actually explained to them, okay, this is what's happening, this is what he said, and this is how it reflects, whatever, something like that.
Okay. Oh, thanks a lot, Grace. I'm just mentally picturing it, and I get what you mean. You say it's not dignified. I think that's quite an apt way to put it. Dennis, I'd actually like to just come to you in terms of the dissemination of the report and the findings. Could you just run us through the findings as you explained it, or as was explained to some of the families and the relatives of the slain mine workers?
I think, Kingsley, one of the questions to ask before even getting into that is what the report was meant to tell us. And I think that's a relatively easy question to answer. I mean, it boils down to the report was meant to tell us within its terms of reference, was meant to tell us what happened at Marikana and why it happened. So within that that framework, I think the least that might have been expected from the report was an individualized account of the massacre. So a body by body account of the deaths, and why that happened, but to a large extent, the reports, the miners, and the evidence put forward by the miners and the families during the commission is to a large extent ignored in the report, and perhaps most painfully for the families, the deceased are dealt with collectively, so in a very sort of generalized way. And this sort of lack of an individualized account of the deaths of their loved ones means that the report fails in what it set out to do, which is ultimately to provide closure to the families about what happened to their loved ones. Never mind accountability.
So I'm just trying to, I mean, I thank you. I think that's important context right before we jump into, you know, what did you say? I mean, what, so it sounds like that was the sort of collective objective expectation of what was supposed to happen. So what did the dissemination end up looking like with this, where it sounds like there's this gap between expectations that we had and that was set up between the commission and the legal teams and the families and relatives. And now you have what we actually got, which was this. So how did you manage this sort of expectation gap in actually having to communicate to the families and communities what we do have, regardless of what we were expecting?
I mean, there are parts of the report that are encouraging. For instance, the findings against Lonman. Lonman came in for some sort of well-deserved criticism in the report, specifically on their sort of social and labor obligations, and especially in the provision of housing and basic services. And this is a positive finding, but it has to be seen in the light that the report doesn't recommend any compensation. I think Farlam sets out that's beyond the terms of reference of the commission. But there are we do think that there are aspects of the report that are going to be useful to the civil claims going forward. But we're very much at the we're very much answered to the families. So we're doing our best to make sure the report is explained as clearly as it is to them, and then we'll take their views forward from there.
Absolutely. And I know, again, it's hard to summarize because we're talking about a lot of people, but what is your general gauge about their reaction and response to sort of what you communicated and what they're hearing from Sere?
This is a point I think that Grace has touched on. Yeah. I can probably speak better to it than me, but it's also what I mentioned earlier. I mean, there's that to say that they're disappointed with the report and its findings is to put it nicely. I mean, if even the way in which the families are acknowledged in the report, they sort of the only real acknowledgement of them is as one of the aid parties who aided the commission. And I mean, in that acknowledgement, you get things like the Tshwane and Rustenburg municipalities. Look, the families weren't at the commission to help the commission. They were there for the truth. They were there for and they were there for justice. And they feel they've been failed in this regard. And a lot of the findings are of no comfort to them at all. I mean, many of the people who watched the president release the report last week will have noticed quite a strong emphasis on first aid and first aid findings and recommendations at the massacre. These sort of findings are of no comfort to the family, especially when you consider that there was medical aid on scene, that Major General Naidu delayed the response of that medical aid. So to say that the families are disappointed, I mean, they've sat at this commission for 2 years now, and unfortunately they're nowhere closer to the truth than about the death of their loved ones than they were 2 years ago.
Thank you for I think a big thing that's at least been bugging me, and as we prepare the show, Greg and I have just been, you know, it's so easy to get caught up on this on outrage that's so distantly removed from the people in question, and it's like it doesn't matter. And it's, I think a big question is what is the feeling about the justice and accountability with the people and the relatives who are actually directly affected by this. So, I mean, it's quite sad to hear that that's the feeling you're getting from them and I think SAID is going to be a big part of trying to sort of correct that as much as we can and try and hopefully create some sense of justice for them. I mean, now that we're talking about the report and the findings of the report, David, I'd actually like to turn to you and to ask, I mean, Dennis has mentioned a bit about the role of the police and how they were implicated, and Lawnmen he spoke about briefly. And I'd like to ask about the executive. So, I mean, there was a general feeling that Cyril Ramaphosa played a big role in some of what happened in the end, and also Mr. Natim Tetra and Susan Shabangu, and do you feel that the law has been correctly applied in how their roles are being seen by the report on the commission? What are your thoughts on that?
Right. Okay. Well, maybe I should just start off by saying that, hear what Grace and Dennis have been saying about the response of the families to the report, and I acknowledge that it, in terms of their needs, it is in many ways satisfactory. But when I read the report, I must say that my first response to it was that it is an important and far-reaching report, and that it does have very important findings, and that it will have profound and important implications in South Africa once it is fully understood. In respect of the issues of the executive, we're getting into sort of complex territory here. But the one thing is that my personal view was that it's likely that the Minister of Police at the time, Natim Tetwa, was involved in the decision-making process relating to the operation, and so if one looks at the findings of the report, I'm not unhappy with the findings of the report in that regard. Essentially, I think what the commission has done is followed quite a, one could call it a kind of conservative approach to making findings. So they've made findings which they feel are fully justified by the evidence. And so where they haven't felt that there is sufficient or that the evidence is clear enough to justify findings, they haven't made findings. And so specifically in the then Minister of Police Mthethwa's case, what they have provided is a type of open finding, which is to say that the evidence isn't effectively that the evidence isn't conclusive enough. I think that I think that it is arguable that the commission, even following the type of approach that it was applying, which was this what I've described as a fairly cautious or conservative approach, that it could have reached a finding on a balance of probabilities that it is likely that Mthethwa was involved in the decision-making process. But nevertheless, what is clear is that in the way in which the president presented the report in the presidency's summary, that was a misrepresentation of the report. That the report does not say that the executive played no role in the operation.
I mean, that's odd because I mean, from watching the president's reading of it, it felt quite clear that that's what he was saying. So you think it's just a clear misrepresentation of what's in the report? Simple as that.
That seems to be the obvious interpretation of it. I mean, the report doesn't say that, and so it seems to be a dishonest misrepresentation of the report's findings to say that. The president said that he needed time to study the report.
86 days, I think. It's
that's it. Right, and so it isn't possible that in that time period he or his assistants misread that finding. And so it would seem to be a clear and deliberate misrepresentation of the report's findings.
David, I was just wondering, you mentioned that you believe the report has far-reaching implications and profound implications that may come out when we understand it better. Can you explain some of those implications for us? And maybe Grace and Dennis might want to add if you guys like.
Right. Okay. I have made some observations about what it does say about the role of the executive, and for instance, there are then recommendations that the report contains about how issues to do with involvement and the directives that are provided by the executive to the Commission of Police should be dealt with in future. But I think the principal issues are that they are. You see, subject to correction. So I think part of the problem that a lot of us are having with this report is that it's very complicated, and so kind of processing the report and coming to terms with it is very challenging because a lot of people are trying to do it in a very concentrated period of time. But the one thing is that I think also possibly what was happening or what is happening in the report is that the commission identifies itself in some ways as having an investigative role, but that the judges on the commission are very conscious of the fact that this isn't in fact a criminal trial process. No one has been charged. No one has had the charges against them clearly stated. And so they aren't in a position to make findings of guilt or innocence or anything like that against anyone. And so, but nevertheless, if you do read the report, there are findings that effectively that the decision to launch the operation is likely to have been an unlawful decision. Secondly, that the shootings at what is known as Scene 1, that at least some of the shooters there are likely to have acted unlawfully. And then essentially then also at Scene 2, and I agree that on questions of detail, the report is in many ways unsatisfactory. But nevertheless, there is a finding that many of the shootings at and killings at Scene 2 are likely to have been unlawful. And so, I mean, I think also just what this means is that, you see, because what the report has, what the report says is that there's this ballistics problem, which is that the bullets from R5 rifles disintegrate or something like that. And so one can't trace, link the bullets from the rifles that killed any one person to a specific rifle. And so as a result, effectively, what the commission concludes is that if the police are convicted eventually, it won't be possible to convict any of them for anything other than attempted murder. But nevertheless, the implication is that a number of the police at Marikana, including police at Scene 1 and Scene 2, are implicated in acts of murder. And so I think then, you know, essentially the point here is that up to this point, the police service specifically have hidden behind the fact that they've claimed that they acted unlawfully. And they said that they were waiting for the findings of the commission. But now the commission has found clearly pointed to the likelihood that in several instances, including the decision-making process and actions by the police at both scenes, were unlawful. And so, you know, as far as I can see, those are the issues that people should now be responding to and taking forward, or some of the issues at least.
I mean, David, I'm sorry to take you back to what you said right at the start, which is, I feel like you're almost sort of toning down the reaction of this is not what we wanted, this is not helpful, the commission did not do its work. And I feel like you're almost saying, hold on, this was always going to be the role of the commission, to sort of be, firstly, be investigative, and almost sort of recommend what happens next. And perhaps, do you think perhaps our expectations of what was always going to come out of this, perhaps were maybe misaligned with what the reality of what was intended? Do you think that's a bit misalignment there?
Well, you see, I'm not quite sure how to respond to that. Okay. All I'm saying is that my first response was that this is an important and a far-reaching report. Okay. I still believe that. I've been listening to a lot of the criticisms of the report, and I can hear that why people are dissatisfied. I'm not quite sure what the final word should be on that issue, but I think possibly this fact that we had judges leading, you know, in charge of the commission, and that they're very conscious of the circumstances in which it's justified to make findings against people, or to make even firm findings about the legality of one action or another. So I think that, you know, possibly that is something that needs to be taken into account in reading the report.
Okay. Thank you, Peter. I think my sort of next question is just around focusing on the role of the police. So a lot of the findings seem to focus on sort of the police and maybe some regulations and things that need to be investigated regarding them in the future. Do you think this could sort of cause a sort of major reform around the future of policing and crowd control in South Africa in the future? A lot of the recommendations that have come out of this.
Well, right at the moment, there's no indication of any ability on the part of the SAPS to move beyond an attitude of denial and minimizing their responsibility for what happened at Marikana. So, you know, essentially it's a question about how to bring a profound reorientation within the police in how they deal with and process respond to the whole issue. And, you know, the obvious point is that this needs to start with change at the level of leadership within the organization. But, it would require a certain a leadership that is committed to going through a process of helping the organization come to terms with the implications of this report and of what happened at Marikana for that kind of type of process of reform to actually become possible and meaningful.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot, Peter. I think
David,
something that
sorry, David.
Jesus, that's embarrassing. Thank you. You can call me a different name for the rest of the show. How's that? Just call me Jason or something.
Maybe that was a joke just to lighten the mood.
I think that was it. There we go. You know, you always know where. Perfect. Gregor, actually, you were in Marikana yesterday. So I'd actually like, I'm quite interested about what the mood was like there yesterday in the wake of the report. And I know some political parties have headed down there. And are you feeling the sense of sort of disappointment that we've heard about from Grace and Dennis? Are you feeling the sense of disappointment? Is there hopefulness about some of the further recommendations that are coming? Are some of the union battles, are some of those things still playing out? I'm just really curious. What's the climate down there right now?
Yeah, so yesterday I was in Marikana because Democratic Alliance National Leader Musi Maimane was in town with some of the Northwest leadership of the DA laying a wreath on the kopi there where the miners obviously protested for a number of days. And so the in terms of the politics there, the DA doesn't really have much of a base, you know. As far as I know, they don't have a branch in Marikana, and not many of the community members turned out to see them. Not many of them seem to really care that the leader of the national opposition was there. I think what's more prominent in Marikana now is both the EFF, as you've seen quite a rise. You see a lot of guys in berets there, and obviously Julius Malema likes to hold rallies in the area. And the UDM, Bantu Holomisa's UDM, is also quite popular. There seems to be some ANC presence there, but you know, it seems to be quite dwindling, and even one of the shack that was a branch office for the ANC was burnt down. I think it was last year or the year before. So, yeah, for Musi Maimane, there wasn't too much response. And from the mine workers I spoke to, they seem to be pretty disgruntled with President Zuma and Cyril Ramaphosa and the ANC. They seem to take the position that the report was biased under retired Judge Ian Farlam, and that the executive, through the commission, is trying to effectively protect Zuma and his allies. So there's quite a disgruntlement on the ground. I spoke to two widows of two people who were killed yesterday in Marikana, Mr. Mabulane and Mr. Nokamba. And particularly Mr. Nokamba's wife was extremely emotional. I think she reflected some of the things that Grace was talking about earlier, in that she's finding it difficult to see any or find any closure or sense of justice given the sort of vagueness, I'd say, of the report, you know, where the report sort of says the police might have been responsible for these things, or, you know, like the report doesn't believe her husband died at what's called Scene 2 at Marikana, the smaller kopi.
So you're saying in that case the report does not believe that that's what happened?
No, the report does not believe the police's version as to what happened, okay, that the police were necessarily acting in self-defense, but it doesn't take the next step further to say
so then what
actually happened and who is to blame.
Okay.
It also doesn't take the next step further to say, let's look at what you've lost in terms of perhaps financial sustainability and how she's going to raise her kids and all those sorts of things. And so I think she was pretty emotional and really saddened by that, and it feels almost seemed listening to her that there's a gaping wound that's been opened and salt continues to be poured in, and the report hasn't helped close that wound. A report like that can never bring back a loved one, but I think there were answers people were looking for that they didn't find. On the other hand, when we spoke to the security guard, Mr. Mabulane's partner, she actually was quite happy that Musi Maimane, the DA leader, visited her, and she actually had finally gotten some attention. And I think, as the media, that's one thing that we could focus a little bit more on sometimes. Both, I think we can always focus more on looking at just the lives that have been affected directly by the Marikana massacre, but also remember that it wasn't just mine workers' lives, it was also security guards and policemen, and it's important to talk about all of them.
Kingsley, do you mind if I...
No, please jump in.
I mean, on this this question of like of parties being present at Marikana, and Greg, I wonder if you know, having been there with the DA's most recent sort of visit, I mean, it struck me as it sort of stands for what I think of sort of like a failure in the popular response to what happened in Marikana, that sort of divisive partisan politics have taken up a lot of space, and I've always thought that the partisan politics should have taken a back seat during all of this, and that popular response should have, you know, rather rallied around Marikana, like PSC and others managed to do quite successfully after Sharpeville. And you know, I think it detracts from sort of important forms of solidarity that may have come out of. So I don't know.
Yeah, I think maybe two points on that. In terms of, there's definitely been a lot of political posturing around Marikana that I've seen, where people have really tried to use it for mileage in terms of gaining supporters and attention for their own parties, you know, coming up to elections and all that sort of stuff. And I think that might be a failure both on the general public side, you know, listening to the news, and the media side, that we sort of allow that to happen. But I also think it's a little bit of a failure from civil society's side as well, that we haven't really seen an effective sort of public campaign or sort of sense of community or grouping around the issue of marijuana, even though a lot of people are outraged by it. I don't know if there's been enough groups that have really managed to rally society around that to effectively put the political posturing in its place. I know some groups have tried to do it, but I don't think they have. And I think what we're seeing is what you're saying is where we have seen partisan politics really take over the issue and often misrepresent what's going on for their own benefit.
I mean that is I mean, one thing that I sometimes worry about, that it just becomes a great opportunity for somebody to just leap in and almost seem as the hero or the anti-ANC or something, and it's you know, I'm not sure it's quite helpful for the situation, and maybe, as you said, maybe it causes more harm than good. We're just going to take a call, an interview with Andries Nkome, who is a representative for some of the injured and arrested mine workers. Andries, can you hear us?
Yes, sir. How are you?
Fantastic. How are you doing today?
I'm good.
Great. Now, Andries, I'm quite interested in your perspective, given some of the people you're representing. Now, we know no police have been yet charged with any killings or murder or attempted murder or anything based on marijuana, but hundreds of your clients have been arrested and have faced charges. So I'm quite curious, how is some of your clients and the mine workers you work with, how are they reacting to the report?
Look, they're quite disappointed with the report, simply because of the fact that it creates a disjuncture insofar as the instructions that was given and the people that executed the act that shot at the people that they were striking with. So they feel that there was no way in which the police could have just acted in the way that they did, especially in the sense of the fact that before the commission, evidence was led to the effect that there were email exchanges that necessitated that concomitant action should be taken. So they felt that it's an act of protection in some way of the people that are sitting in their executive.
I mean, I hear you. I can imagine it being quite hard to reconcile mentally that some of the mine workers have been, you know, charged, and some people, and seeing who could feel like the people responsible, seeing the police and hearing that there will be more investigations and further looking into, and it feels like people want answers now. And I'm quite curious is what, based on the conversations you're having with your team, is what happens now. We've had conversations about another commission. There's been suggestion of going to the ICC. So what options are you considering now?
Look, we sat in the past Sunday in a consultation with our clients, explaining to them the import of the recommendations in the commission and how the judge seems to have arrived at those conclusions. And, you know, the client found it very odd that they said for close on 3 years, trying to find closure in so far as who really caused the deaths on the fateful day. But unfortunately, the inquiry was only recommending yet another inquiry. At the end of the day, to them, it is that justice is being delayed. And we know for a fact that justice delayed is as good as justice denied. So therefore, it's for that reason that they feel maybe through the South African forum, there's no way in which they can find truth, they can find closure, and they can put blame onto anybody else. Maybe we ought to look into, for example, the Rome Statute, to which we are still a signatory, and try to find whether we can be accommodated there insofar as, you know, the atrocities that they had to face at the hands of the police.
I mean, I just find it quite interesting that we're sort of going back to conversations about the ICC and the Rome Statute, given some of the issues we've had with Omar al-Bashir and the issues of wanting to pull out of the ICC. And I just feel like it's quite interesting that we're now turning to the ICC perhaps as the next recourse for that. So Andries, I think just final question from us what is the consultation looking like with your clients in terms of, now it's to talk about international law and the Rome Statute, and there's more commissions, and how are you feeding in their response and their input into making that decision?
One thing is certain, from the time that we met with them, I went to Marikana for the first time on the 18th of August in 2012, and that was on a Saturday. From that time up until now, the instruction that we should sue the state for all of this injuries, for all the arrests, for all the unlawful detentions, together with the pain and suffering that they have had to endure, they have been saying that we should sue the state. Now, after the commission, they say, despite the fact that some people have not been fingered, people that are sitting high up in the executive, like the former Minister of Police, Nati, together with the DMR Minister, Student Shabangu, as well as our Deputy President, Cyril Ramaphosa, they feel that we should continue and sue them in their personal capacity. And again, they as well say that maybe we need to review the findings of the commission simply because of the fact that evidence was put there before the commission, including, amongst others, the evidence of the expert police witness that had, I think he came from America. And he was saying that there was no way in which the violence and the massacre could have unfolded in the way that it did in Marikana had it not been, or had there been no political pressure or executive pressure that was exerted. And the judge suddenly then chose to believe the version of a Mr. X, who was proven in so many respects to have lied in front of the commission. Remember, at one point, he had said that a picture showing some people who had bowed their heads and we could not see their faces. He claimed that one of those people was him, was himself. Now, fortunately, our client was the one that was there in the picture, and he still had the same jersey that he had on the particular day. So we showed Mr. X and said, the gentleman that was there in the picture is this. Where is your jersey, the one that resembles this? And Mr. X could not, even having been given time, he could not produce that. So at the end of the day, they feel that the findings of the commission is just a travesty, and we ought to find some forum before which we can review these findings. They should find some forum before which the people that are high up in the executive and feel that they can manipulate systems that are applicable in South Africa can be brought to book, probably, maybe through the ICC or any other entity. For so long, for now, still, the understanding is that we are still signatories of the Rome Statute.
I mean, you're right. At the end of the day, you know, that is an option that you may consider. Andries, thank you so much. And we look forward to seeing sort of the next steps you take, and hopefully ends in a feeling of justice for your clients. Thank you so much.
You're most welcome, sir. Enjoy that.
Perfect. Now, Grace and Dennis, I'd like to come back to you, especially after Andries is mentioning sort of further legal action. And it's something that I think, Grace, you mentioned briefly. And is that something that you feel like your clients are hoping for, want to pursue? Or is there a feeling that, you know, maybe this is it and maybe we just leave this whole thing alone now?
Most definitely. When we consulted with them on, I think it was a Friday when we got to VET.
Okay.
We explained to them what the report says and what is satisfaction with the outcome. But then we sort of gave them hope not to give up, because we are still, as per the instructions, though, that we will still pursue suing the government. And we will be going to the Eastern Cape to because the families in the Marikana are not the only ones. We have families in the Eastern Cape. Those are here in the Marikana, they're the ones that are working, but we have more families again in the Eastern Cape. So we'll be taking further instructions, going to the Eastern Cape next week, I think, from the 6th to the 16th. So we'll be consulting with the families and getting instructions as to how to go about doing the civil claims.
I think it's quite clear that that civil claims will be pursued.
Okay, so that's happening. It's not even like we will maybe look into the options. It's happening.
Yeah, I mean, we're still very much in consultation with the families.
Okay.
But I mean, it's certainly our view that the report has failed in its most fundamental task, which was to reveal the truth about what happened to those men who were slain at Marikana. And I think in light of that failure, I think that these civil claims, together with what needs to be, I mean, Greg, you've touched on this in terms of the media's response, but what needs to be a more rigorous and popular public debate, that these civil claims, together with that, might now need to take the lead in establishing the truth behind probably our greatest post-apartheid atrocity. And I mean, I think, yeah, this debate needs to take into account things that where where the commission and the report have sort of fallen short. Things like, I mean, we can't, and I think especially now in light of the report, technicalities and sort of and very procedural issues are being discussed, and rightly so. Mm. I just worry about the fact that. And this is something that the report didn't manage to touch on at all because it was beyond its terms of reference. But the fact that these men were killed in the struggle for a living wage, so I think this sort of like legacy of migrant labour, for instance, where if you think of what's happened at UCT recently, sort of symbolic victories have been won against these things. Let's say in the falling of the Rhodes statue, but the material realities of this legacy remain very much entrenched and shape these families' lives. And I think these sort of things where the sort of commission failed to address are going to have to be a part of that public debate.
Was that one of the things? Do you think one of the key issues with the Falun Commission was the effective shelving of Phase 2, where looking to socioeconomic conditions, things like the migrant labour system, things like the structure of union negotiations, things like worker debt, all these sort of things that really did fuel a lot of the issues behind the strike and even potentially the level of violence that was seen. Is that one of the things you would have really liked to seen explored more throughout the commission? And because without that, it feels like we don't really understand the full story.
Yeah, I mean, I hesitate to say that in light of the fact that the commission had 2 years and has still sort of not come to anything which we find satisfactory, I hesitate to say that we would have liked them to touch on that more. But I think they're certainly important questions. I mean, at the heart of all of this, there are questions of how income from production needs to be divided between workers and capital, and I think those questions are very very much at the heart of it, and the sort of the forms of exclusion and violence that this migrant labour. I mean, look, Marikana has the conditions that have led to something like Marikana have been in place for a very long time. So I do think they're important questions, but Greg, I hesitate to give the commission more responsibility.
I hear you. I'm sorry, David, I was looking at you because he sort of had a wry smile when Greg was talking about the shelving of some of the other things. But I'm curious, what are you looking to next? I know you've written about and spoken a bit about how you feel some of the reaction to the commission has been lacking in a few things. And sort of what's key for you in terms of what we should be looking to next? Now that we've heard from the president, the report is now public, what sort of the key things you're looking to now?
Well, in some ways, the central fact for me is that now, you see, up to this point, what the SAPS has disputed, the simple contention that any of their members acted wrongfully or unlawfully at Marikana. So now from Thursday, it is now in the public domain. Presumably they knew about this prior to Thursday, but anyway, now it's in the public domain, that the Commission of Inquiry that has been established to look into this matter has found prima facie that a number of their members are likely to have acted unlawfully at Marikana. And so so what that means is that the SAPS should not be able to go on in relation to the situation, as treating it as just business as usual. Basically, there should be a process that should have already been initiated within the SAPS for the members who are reasonably suspected to have acted unlawfully to be suspended, and potentially also those members then should be undergo a disciplinary process and should be expelled from the SAPS. So aside from the issue of civil claims and possible a criminal prosecution process, the essential point for me is that we should be moving quite quickly to a situation where people who are reasonably suspected of having acted unlawfully at Marikana are expelled from the SAPS. And the SAPS shouldn't be allowed. I mean, obviously, that needs to be a process that is follows the norms of due process that are required in disciplinary processes. But the SAPS shouldn't be allowed to delay or defer this issue any further.
David, it seems. I think most people would agree that, especially now that we have the findings of the report have come out and finding that some police officers did act unlawfully. But we've known for a long time that police officers definitely, they killed people, and there were accusations that they murdered some people. And yet we haven't seen any officers be suspended. We haven't seen the police try to hold anybody to account. Now that we have these findings, is there a way that we can be sure that the police might actually hold disciplinary actions for their members, or try to hold their members to account? And for that matter, is there, and this could be for the whole panel here, is there a mechanism to ensure that the MPA does investigate the possibility of laying charges at the hands of certain perpetrators in Marikana, or can these recommendations just go unheeded?
Well, you know, my inclination is to rely on the fact that the SAPS is going to go on dragging its feet on this. Okay. So I don't think, I think this kind of obfuscatory approach to the issue is what we can continue to expect from the SAPS. But I think that it's possible, you know, I'm not a lawyer, but I think that there are mechanisms that the South African legal and constitutional framework allows, whereby, for instance, the families can demand that the SAPS account to them as to that they have a direct interest in the fact that the SAPS applying the administrative procedures that it's duty bound to apply. And I think that I would imagine that the families have recourse through the court also to seek to enforce a process of that kind.
I mean, the question about the MPA, Greg, I think it brings up again the sort of why some of the findings being sort of so conservative in general and lacking some of the more specific evidence. To take this to the MPA and say we need further investigations, and in that sort of just general sense, is a bit worrying for me. I think if we could if the commission had taken something to the MPA which is a little bit more sort of specific and had used you know, for instance, some of the postmortems a postmortem for every minor was submitted at the commission. These sort of like more specific things, I think it would have been a more sort of hopeful thing to take to the MPA.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Dennis. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have. A big thank you to all our guests. That's Greg, Grace, Dennis, and David, and Andres, who we spoke to over the phone. Thank you all for coming in, and please keep up the excellent work you're doing in your different spheres. Please download the podcast and share. You've just listened to the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. We will see you next week.
CliffCentral.com.